All right, continuing. From this experience, did you decide to become a theoretical chemist? Or?
No. I moved from Furman's operation to work with Charles Smythe. This would be, I guess, when I was a sophomore, maybe. And there are a couple of papers in there with my name and Smythe on it.
Yes, the dielectric polarization of liquids and electric moment and molar structure.
The I worked in the lab, in his laboratory. By the way, he's 90-something or other and going strong right now. I mean, he's not doing any science work, I know.
Yeah.
So it appears there. And his brother just died at age 90, I think. Mm. Harry Smythe of Smythe Report. Well, no, I kept on doing experimental work, first with Smythe a couple of years, then with Bill Richards. And then with Pauling a little bit. But it was pretty clear that I wasn't all that great in the laboratory. Well, it wasn't all that clear. I mean, I did all right in Princeton laboratory, except in quantitative analysis course. But I certainly... I don't consider myself a pure theoretician, incidentally. I think that what I do best is perhaps is think of experiments and then get somebody else to do them.
Did you like organic chemistry or ever consider?
No, I didn't like organic chemistry much. Mm-hmm. It seemed to me that it wasn't a very good course, I must say. It seemed to me we'd set up a still every time we went in the laboratory, and I'd figure out what it is we'd distill later when I had to write up the experiment. And I didn't get much out of that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I got to know. It really was a fairly limited course.
What, you have any recollection of the text used?
No, I have no idea what
What about the physical chemistry course?
The physical chemistry course was given by this man, his name is rattling around the wrong part of my brain at the moment. Not very well.
Was this before...
Jeff Webb. T. Jefferson Webb.
Was this... when did Hugh Taylor write his big treatise on physical chemistry?
It must have been about that time, because I have a copy of it, and I bought it when I was there. He probably came out in my junior year, thereabouts. But Webb was teaching the physical chemistry course. I took that during the second or third year.
Well, then, Taylor's book was not used as teaching text?
No.
Was it more a reference text?
It's a reference thing. It's very, very big detail. Two volumes. There was a student in the graduate school. I stayed a year in graduate school, basically. So there was one chemist there who flunked the preliminary exams one time after another. And he realized he studied out of that big two-volume set. It was just inappropriate for that, because, you know, you can't go through and really learn in detail that much material in any sense about what he was trying to do.
Now, Jeff Sturcio saw a senior thesis, or maybe it was a master's thesis title, on quantum chemistry,
right,
or quantum mechanics, that you wrote.
This is my senior year. We had a thesis requirement, in fact, a junior thesis and a senior thesis. The junior thesis wasn't much, it was sort of paraphrasing Devine's paper. I think it was on the frequency dependence, but I don't remember, actually. It's on the dipole moment stuff, anyway. It wasn't original at all. It wasn't supposed to be. My senior thesis, I worked with, oh God, I don't have this every time a name comes up. He was in the physics department, and
you never published any of this outside with this?
The senior thesis appeared only as a Princeton thesis, mm-hmm. but it really was a little book on quantum mechanics. I have it around somewhere. I worked with this man. He was very helpful indeed.
Had he been to Europe, or what was his background?
Well, at that time,
quantum theory.
I don't know where he picked up his knowledge of this. This is right. You see, I was a freshman in 1926, I guess it was. 1930 is when I graduated from Princeton. So it was 29-30 that during the thesis. Well, Ed Condon came to Princeton just before that, I think when I was a junior perhaps, and I took his course in mechanics. He was busy at that time writing Condon and Morse. Phil Morse was there with him as a postdoctoral fellow, I think, and they were writing their book on quantum mechanics, which is really the first American textbook, I think.
Now, where was Condon at the time?
He was at Princeton. He'd come to Princeton.
He was on the faculty at Princeton.
He was on the faculty at Princeton. But he left after 1 year, went to Iowa, and then came back again the next year, mm-hmm. and then stayed for a while.
Now, was the course he taught classical mechanics, or was it...
He taught classical mechanics my junior year, I guess it was. And then 2 years later, at any rate, while I was there, he gave a course out of Dirac, or Dirac's book, which is a theory. I attended that, but that was rather much for me. But working on the senior thesis was close help from the professor. I put out a thesis which certainly... That thesis job helped me very much in dealing with our book later on, Pauling and Wilson. And I don't mean that it was anything original in it as a thesis at all, but it certainly helped me understand the subject.
Would there be a copy of that in the Princeton library, or would yours be the only...
I don't know. I have it around here somewhere. I dug it out a few years back. Somebody asked me about it. There's a physics study similar to this oral history business. Physics, you know about theirs.
The Physical Society, the American Physical Society, has done a much better job, or started much sooner in
they
the started history.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now they've got, one of them talked to me about the quantum mechanics, never a full-fledged interview like yours, but mm-hmm. and I dug it out at that time, and I think it's around here somewhere.
Now, what was your master's degree work and thesis?
Well, I didn't have any master's thesis, but I worked with William T. Richards, who was the son of T.W. Richards at Harvard. Very Harvard fellow, very nice guy, who had a particular friend named George Kistiakowsky down there. That's where I met George first. But Richards was a fine fellow, and he had ideas, and he was working on the velocity of sound and things. And I did something with him as a first-year graduate student. There's a paper there, actually, one paper, sort of scraped up off the floor. Yes. It wasn't much of a... It didn't accomplish much there.
Velocity of sound and solutions of benzene and et cetera.
Yeah.
Yeah. But he was a physical chemist also.
He was a physical chemist, mm-hmm. Right. And he did something special for me. It was fun. I don't know that it really had a big effect on my career, but... Alfred Loomis was a investment person, Wall Street person, some kind of very wealthy man. And he had set up a laboratory in Tuxedo Park, New York. He had a house there. He bought a second house. And he converted half of it into a laboratory that had concrete floor. So he made a laboratory out of it. The rest of the house he used as a living quarters for visiting scientists who worked in the laboratory. And it was a private, personal operation he had there, you see, financed with his own money. And it was rather fabulous. I went up there in one summer, maybe two summers, with Bill Richards, who had an entree and invited to work there. And one of the people who was there was some sort of a star person. Famous optical physicist, made grading.
Oh, Strong? Or before
no.
Strong? Wood.
Wood.
Wood. R.W. Wood, okay.
Yeah, and he had this fabulous collection of stories that he loved to tell. I admit he repeated himself eventually, but they were wonderful stories. And there were some other people there, I can't remember their names, I don't know them anymore. There was an astronomer from Yale who was busy making calculations on planetary motions, I think, interactions. There was a man from Bell Labs who was sort of the originator of the crystal clock idea. And quartz piezo electric. And Loomis got interested in clocks, and he ordered three of the best, very best pendulum clocks, Riffler clocks in the world, set them up on special concrete piers in the basement. And then he had this guy from Bell Labs that provided three crystal clocks. And then they kept records, and they had a radio to pick up time signals from all over the world. And then the astronomer from Yale, I think it was, analyzed this stuff. For example, they got the effect of the gravity on the Earth tides, you see, pushing the clocks up and down daily, and could see this effect.
Was the effect measurable?
They could measure it out, oh, yeah. See, they had a year, two or three years of data, and put a Fourier series on it, and pull all these things out of it. I don't think anything very profound came out of it, I must say.
Was this before the radio frequency standards were broadcast from the National Bureau of Standards?
That's right,
and so
oh
on?
Yes. Yes, indeed, I think so.
Would have been...
I think so, I wouldn't be quite so sure. At any rate, the idea of the Grazo clock that I think was kind of this Bell Lab man, not much earlier than that. Another fellow who was there was the Englishman, wrote a book on soap bubbles once, but he was more famous than that. Englishman, sorry, that name's go away.
You can always insert it when we edit.
Yeah, if I think of it yes. In the meantime.
Oh, you mentioned Wood. I think Kostyakovsky's.
He was there later. He went to Tuxedo Park himself later.
Oh, Kostyakovsky
yeah.
Did. Yeah, he mentioned Wood, apparently most of the Raman effect. That was a story I'd not heard.
I can tell you about the Raman effect, because I was there when that happened. The Raman effect was discovered by Raman, was published by him in Nature, I believe. And a copy of Nature arrived at Tuxedo Park, and Wood saw it. And immediately went into the laboratory, I mean, probably within minutes, but anyway, within hours, into the laboratory and began typical wood improvisation. And he took a quartz crystal, took a bucket and a rubber tube, and he put the water in the bucket, and then he put dye in it to filter out one of the lines, mercury lamp, set up the mercury lamp. A quartz crystal, or a crystal, I mean, it was quartz now, I don't know. He made a solid state Raman with a crystal or something. And he verified the Raman effect within a day or two and dashed off a note to nature, verification of the Raman effect. There's, you know, clothespin holding the pail, and everything like that is typical. Wood improvisations that work.
So did you, your publications with Smythe originated from work there, or?
No, that was the work I did at Princeton.
Mm-hmm. What in particular did you do with the tuxedo?
I accomplished absolutely nothing. Richards was trying to do something on supercooled water, supercooled liquids, and I was incapable of contributing to that, frankly. I mean, I fooled around, or I don't remember the difficulty, but I got into some kind of experimental difficulty, and Richards was not able to get me out of it. I mean, he couldn't fix it either, and that was a failure. It was all a failure. Wood stories stick with me.
Fine.
Boy, is that right? Soap bubble man. I think it is B-O-Y-S, but I'm not absolutely sure.
I can't say myself. Mm-hmm. You mentioned to me
one of the people weighed the earth fairly.
I was coming back to Princeton. You mentioned to me once that you had close relations with the Princeton faculty. In fact, that you sought them out and
I wasted a lot of that time. I gave it freely.
Physics as well as chemistry or other subjects?
Well, physics, no. Not except my thesis advisor. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't want to know. I had a freshman course in physics, a big course for all students. And the man who gave it was my memory of him, an old man, of course, he's probably a good many years younger than I am today. He thinks, well, at any rate, he just couldn't understand and couldn't accept, not quantum mechanics, but quantum theory, the idea of quanta. Gee was his name. And I went to him about research at the same time I went to Fermin. And he turned me down very properly. But he explained that, well, you know, in physics you couldn't really do these things, so you had a lot more training, and so on. And I didn't have close relationships, really. With Condon I did. With my thesis advisor, I did. With Harry Smythe, who was a professor of physics, I took a special course on spectroscopy that he worked up just for me and for another student, Bill Preston, who became professor at Harvard later on. He's retired now. He and I went to Smythe. We went because another professor gave a course in the catalog, but it said in the catalog, go see the professor before you signed up for the course. And he was out of town and that year, didn't give the course, and somebody told me, well, it's too bad because he hasn't given that course in 5 years. He'd love to have somebody take it. But instead, Harry Smythe fixed up something special for us.
How large was Princeton then, undergraduate college?
I think my class had about 600 students in it, if I remember correctly, originally.
And how many would you have in chemistry?
Oh, it was very small. Chemistry had about six or eight concentrators. Physics was even smaller. Mm-hmm. I think there were five concentrators or something like that. And it stayed, they both stayed small for a long time.
Speaking of spectroscopy, what was the state of the art when you took spectroscopy in Princeton?
Well, that was purely experimental. Actually, it wasn't all that much spectroscopy, as a matter of fact. I guess it was the other course that was spectroscopy that we wanted to take and wasn't given. And we had this laboratory course. So actually, we put together a little homemade mass spectrometer. And I can now speak learnedly to my colleagues who use them all over the place, you know, detectors and beams and so on. And they have troubles. They have the same troubles we had. You get surfaces that are corroded and the charges build up on them and deflect the beam, can't focus it and so on.
What kind of focusing did you use, or how did this operate?
Oh, well, you know, I don't remember the details, but I think it was
electronic acceleration.
You accelerated, yeah, you made the ions, you accelerated them in the field. Now, whether it was magnetic deflection or just electric, I think there was a magnet involved. I think there was, Yeah, we had a magnet, a special. I think that part of it was sort of a little box with a field and a magnet.
How did you detect?
I don't remember what kind of a surface. I mean, the beam had hit something, but whether it was, whether it was a special material so that you.
Was there something like flame photometry, spectroscopy?
No, there was no flame involved.
Not thinking of other forms of spectroscopy.
Oh. Well, actually, we didn't do anything else.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't do spectroscopy. It was Henry Norris Russell was his name. He's the big astronomer of the day at Princeton. He gave the spectroscopy course. And then he wasn't giving it that year. He was abroad, so we took a quite different course.
His spectroscopy course would have been atomic spectroscopy.
I would have been atomic spectroscopy. In those days, every university had a physics department, had a big rolling circle, 21-foot grating, and a big special room. Everybody had one of those things. Now there isn't. You wouldn't find one in the United States as a whole, I think. But physics, I think they tend to go in fads. The waves, they play much more so than physical chemists. There's one thing at a time is fashionable in physics.
Let's see. Well, were there any of your colleagues, fellow students at Princeton, that you particularly remember or that you'd like to make comments about?
Well, one person who was quite a bit of help to me as an undergraduate, he was 2 years ahead of me, George Kimball, came across the chemistry in Columbia eventually.
He wrote the book on quantum chemistry?
That's right, with Henry Eyring.
Yes.
He became a student of Eyring's, but when I knew him, I was an undergraduate. He was 2 years ahead of me, first as an undergraduate, and then as he was there, and I knew him as a graduate student too. He was a very smart fellow, very learned. I have a story about him that I like. It seems that people saw him in the chemistry laboratory, where he spent a lot of time there. He was a chemist. And people had trouble finding certain professors at a certain hour. And they discovered that they were assembling, physical chemists were assembling in a laboratory in a room there. And they're learning quantum mechanics from George Kimball, who was a first year graduate student, I guess, at that point. He hadn't written the book yet, with Iring. He was lecturing as a student to his own faculty there. He was not only a very clever and very learned and very intelligent, but he was a very good lecturer too. So I learned a lot from him, just asking him questions. I mentioned Bill Preston, who was... But, you know, in these chemistry and physics, little groups of four or five, there weren't all that many famous people, I'll tell you. They were not outstanding, mostly.
Well, just to mention the people you mentioned, though, is impressive. Now, how did you come to go to Caltech?
That was very simple. First of all, Richards urged me to leave and go to Harvard. He wanted me to go to Harvard. Well, I didn't know anything about Harvard. I didn't know anything about Caltech. I've heard of Pauling. I talked to Taylor. He said, you go to Caltech and work with Pauling. So I did.
How was this arranged? Did you just apply formally, or did Taylor call Pauling or something?
I'm sure he called up Pauling or wrote to them or something.
Yeah.
And I was admitted.
Were you, it was established when you were going that you were going to work for Pauling?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Which isn't a good idea in general, I'd say. We don't let our students do that, as you know. They can't sign up until they've had a year of finding out who's here. It's right for them.
Now, how was your Princeton education financed? By the family?
Up until the stock market crash, my father was, on paper, a wealthy man. And he paid for my Princeton education. 1929 came and he lost everything. I had a very hard time. So when I went out to Caltech, I had a teaching fellowship. In those days you could live on a teaching fellowship and go to school. Become difficult to do because the price of tuition has gone up so much more than the rate of pay for these jobs. I don't think people can do that anymore. I'd say most of my colleagues my age lived on teaching fellowships and got their advanced degrees that way.
Let's pause now for a change of tape.